Beginning a series on Jewish history, a brand new series, and we will develop it as we go along. When we study history, not necessarily Jewish history, but history in general, we have to be aware of a few points. Firstly, it's history. We weren't there. So we have to wonder what sources are legitimate sources for studying history. For the sake of our studies, we will use the Midrashim, the Rishonim, the Talmud. And that poses a certain challenge because sometimes we have to wonder, did our sages mean it literally? When they say Medrash, that time stopped. There was no day or night during the flood. Did they mean that literally? Well, when you look at the Gra's commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, you see that when the Gra tries to figure out the Jewish calendar dating all the way back to creation, the Gra says, and what do we do about that year? So you see, he took it literally, the Gra and Shulchan Aruch. He understood to mean, yes, there was no day and there was no night. So he asks, was there a year? And he says a phenomenal concept. He just says it, takes it for granted. If there were people, there was a year. If there wouldn't have been people, there wasn't a year. So then the first 6 days of creation where there were no people, then according to the Gra, over there in Shulchan Aruch, time, well, that's a good question what those first 6 days mean. Because the Gra says the definition of the year is defined by there being people around for that year. So we can say, well, we could say a lot of things, but we're digressing, so it's not our topic tonight, so we're not going to go into that right now. But our challenge, and I don't have a formula really how to deal with this challenge. So we're going to have to basically find our way through this labyrinth of different sources. Our challenge is going to be where did Chazal mean it literally, and where were Chazal talking figuratively, and that will not be the focus of our class. So we're just going to take Chazal at face value, more or less. And Chazal obviously is a general term. Our sages, you know, who does that include? But the first question is our sources. And even though we will say, oh, we're using authentic sources, but the interpretation of the sources, that's the big question. So we don't really have a good formula. If we would take a work like we have in the past, like the Meiri's work on Jewish history, or Rav Halperin's work on Jewish history, or another work, so at least you know what you're studying. Here you're studying Nathanael Frankenthal. I'm not sure it's worth it, but I'm going to try to put together from different sources and get a little bit of a picture of what's going on. So the first challenge is our sources. So we discussed how we're going to try and address that. The second challenge is, similar to the first, we don't know. We don't really know what went on. We have very little sources on history. I mean, no one's sitting and writing down what's going on every day, right? So then you have a choice to focus on two things, either major events or major people in history. But when you're studying history, what else are you going to do? So we're going to try and divide our study of history or Jewish history into those two areas, studying major events, studying major people, and through that trying to get a picture of history. There are other points to be discussed. You could study major philosophies of the time, and we'll touch on that a little bit because it's relevant to a lot of Jewish history. You can study major failures, major successes, and we will have to discuss that as well. Let's begin, and as we go along, you'll help me figure out together what style this class should take. So, I always like, in many subjects, I like to start each class the same way. And I believe that whenever you study a subject, there should be a general picture, and then to zone in and understand more and more and more as you go along. So, to my mind, when you study history, you always have to start with a timeline. And the timeline has to start at the beginning and end today. and then you start filling in the timeline and zoning in. But you basically always have to have that perspective. And I think that when we study history, it's beneficial to try and create timelines in our head, or major timeline, where we can plot a lot of points. So let's say we're going to talk about Avraham Avinu. How many years after creation was Avraham Avinu around? Who knows? 2000. Okay? So Avraham Avinu, it took him 52 years till he was 52 to discover monotheism. When he was 52, he discovered the monotheism. I know the Midrashim say 3, but the Talmud says 52. Avraham Avinu is 52 years old, and the year is 2000. And we are told that the world is divided into series of 2000. The first 2000 years being Tohu, however we'll translate that, void. The second 2000 years being years of Torah, and the third 2000 years, days of Messiah. What does that mean? The Gemara is discussing the days of Messiah. So that needs work, but you do have that Gemara in Avodah Zarah and in Sanhedrin, where the Gemara says world history is divided like that. You have another Medrash that says that world history is divided into series of single thousands, into millennium, where the 6 days of creation correspond to 6 millennium. But that's not so relevant to us. What I want is that we should have markers in history so that we can always place things. We can begin by understanding, okay, if creation was 5773 years ago, 5,773 years ago, so I know I have 5,773 years to figure out. In the year 2000, I know I have Avraham Avinu. So I have a marker there. I have 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, and then Avraham Avinu is born in the year 1948 and is 52 years old in the year 2000. So far, we have a general picture. We're okay? Yes? Fine. Part of what we want to do is also put together the information we're going to learn from Jewish history to world history. So what do you know from the year 2000 in world history? So how do we calculate, if I want to calculate the Jewish date from the Gregorian date, what do I do? So let's go back 2 weeks ago to the year 5772, because you always have this little gap between Rosh Hashanah and New Year's where the Jewish year shifted and the Gregorian date didn't shift. So let's go back to 5772, because that's most of the year. That's the difference between the years. You have 5772 and the year, what's the Gregorian calendar? 2012, right? Okay. So do 5772 minus 2012, and what do you get? What do you get? All our quick mathematicians, you get 3760, right? Okay, so the difference between the Jewish date and the Gregorian date is going to be 3760, meaning you subtract 3760 from the Jewish date, you get the Gregorian date. You add 3760 to the Gregorian date, you get the Jewish date, except for these few months where the Jewish calendar shifts forward and the Gregorian calendar does not yet. Okay, so in the year 2000 minus 3760, we're talking about 1760 BCE. What do we know from that year? Da-da-da-da-dum. Okay, you guys have to think. Let's move forward. We're going to work on that, and we're going to plot points. So let's work differently, just to get a picture. Plato. When did Plato live?
After that.
Right. When did Plato live?
He talked with Yom Yom.
Oh, okay. So when did Plato live, approximately?
700 BC.
Somewhere around 700 BCE, right. So let's get an overview of Jewish history and then start plotting our points. We have 2000 is Avram, and then 2448 we have the Exodus from Egypt. 2448, so I add 448, right? 2448 minus 3760, guys. We need an Excel spreadsheet here to plot in the dates. Okay, 2448. Is the Exodus, 2488, 40 years later we enter Israel. When do we build the temple? Homework for tomorrow. When do we build the temple? So, you guys have to figure out for the next class when the temple was built, open up the Book of Kings and figure it out. So, we build the temple, and we have the period of the first temple, the exile, 70 years in Babylon, second temple destroyed, approximately the year 70 in the Common Era. Now, what we have to know is that that period from the destruction of the first temple to the destruction of the second temple, there's a great discrepancy between our sources and the world history sources. World history suggests there were many more years, a few centuries, that we were out in exile, Persia, for example, that the Persian Empire lasted a few centuries longer than our tradition says. And so here you enter an area where you have a question about our calendar. How does our calendar fit with a world history calendar? And you have different answers. I'd rather leave it as a question. I don't believe I have to answer every question. It's legitimate to have questions, okay? So we reached the period of the destruction of the Second Temple approximately. So we said the first temple was built, going with the simple understanding of our tradition, the first temple was destroyed approximately 450, minus 450 BCE, right? 450 BCE, somewhere around the year 500 BCE, and that's somewhere around where Jeremiah and Plato meet, okay? So that's one marker. Now we have Second Temple, we have the period of the destruction of the Second Temple, and what period is that as far as the rabbis? Tanoim, right? That's the period of the Mishnah. The destruction of the First Temple is under the leadership of whom? Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. He is the great leader during that period. Destruction of the Second Temple, I'm sorry. And we have then the period of Tanoim leading into the period of Amoraim, the rabbis of the Talmud. Ravina, Ravashi, the ceiling of the Talmud, Rabban Savaroi, an overlap between the rabbis of the Talmud and the Gaonic period, leading into the Rishonim, where we hit the year 1100, 1200, and 1200 in the Common Era, and we have Rashi and Maimonides, right? Who are contemporaries of Rashi and Maimonides? What could we plot from the year 1100, 1200 from the general world? Is a little earlier? Yeah? Who can we plot? So we have to look. We have to see who we can plot in the year 1100, 1200. We're entering the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages. And then we hit the Shulchan Aruch. An easy way to remember, 1492, the Spanish Inquisition. Rabbi Yosef Caro is in Tzfat writing the Shulchan Aruch. So here you have an overlap, two things that are happening. You have now, the whole period of the 11, 12, 1300s is the period of the Crusades. So you have a tremendous destruction going on in the Jewish communities throughout Europe. And then, so we said 1400s is where you're going to shift from Rishonim to Achronim, and then you have the period of the Gra and the Baal Shem Tov, and then you run into the period of today, right? So we just did a quick overlap of history, highlighting people, events. Now let's start zoning in. Creation, okay? 6 days of creation, we'll go with the simple understanding that it was 6 days, day and night. We don't really understand what happened there. And then you have Adam. We don't know too much about Adam. The Talmud tells us that Adam, his head reached the heavens, his feet was on earth. So we don't assume that to be literal. Adam and Eve separate for 130 years. Their marriage lasted a few hours. And then they separated for 130 years before they could make up again and have their son Seth. It is from Seth who all of the world evolved because everyone else was destroyed in the flood. Noah came from Shet. So Shet is the one that's called Vayolid Bidmuto Kitzalmo. He's the one that took on the form of Adam, whatever that means. The other ones didn't exactly take his form. So not only did their marriage not last, their children did not continue in their footsteps. They're both violent people. Chazal say that they really fought. Chazal don't have such nice things to say about Cain or Hevel, Cain or Abel. And so we end up with Shet. Okay, so he's the future of humanity. And during the next 10 generations where Adam sees his great-great-grandchildren, and our sages say that beyond great-great-grandchildren, you don't care. Meaning that there's only so far that a person's care can go. Chazal say it's three generations. After three generations, people have a hard time caring for them. You know, it's nice. Yeah, he comes from me, but the connection is just, it's not so much there. And I once had a conversation with an elderly person, and they basically backed that. They didn't want to say that in front of their great-great-grandchildren, but they were like, yeah, I know those little ones are connected to me somehow, right? But, you know, so people are connected to their children, and they're connected to a lesser degree to their grandchildren. And their great-grandchildren, they're connected to an even lesser degree. When you get to great-great-grandchildren, so there already the connection is just like, okay, we're connected somehow. And that's basically what happens. You have Adam, and you have everyone after him, and for the first 930 years of the world, you don't have idol worship. It's only after Adam dies that people can allow themselves to get away with starting to push idol worship. Why were they pushing idol worship? So there are one of a few possibilities. If they're given the six Noahide laws in creation, so that's limiting, that's constricting. And it's constricting in a real sense and in a psychological sense. If I told you, you can do whatever you want, just don't go out that door. You could go out that door, you could do whatever you want, just not out this door. So you automatically get fucked. You want to go out that door. You spent your whole life in this classroom never going out that door. You always went out that door. But now that someone told you, you could anywhere you want, you could go, but just don't use that door, okay? I have one request of you. Suddenly it's very hard. Eat from all the fruits of the garden, God tells Adam. But one. Had he tasted all the fruits that he was running after that one? You know, but that's human nature. That's the challenge. It deserves a broader discussion, not for now. But so you have a situation where the one challenge in it is, well, he told me not to, so I want to. The second challenge in it is that religion can be used to control others. So if I can tell people that I know, and if I could tell people that there are gods, and if I could tell people that there are forces, then I could also tell people what to do, and I could legitimize doing whatever I want. It's not only about not doing what the omnipotent wants, it's also about a way of controlling others and getting what I want. So it's pretty natural that this is where the world will evolve to. And you see, it's a recurring theme in world history. The world keeps evolving in directions where people want to take advantage of other people, and they use religion as a method to do that. So you have that recurring theme from Adam to Noah, and then again from Noah to Avraham Avinu. The people start being pagans. Initially, they believe there is God, but there are other forces at play. And over time, people start forgetting there is God. They just think about the other forces. And people are very, very corrupt to the point where people use the power they have to steal other people's wives and daughters. And the world becomes a place of cruelty. And God says, I don't want this. So he brings the flood. And that brings us to the first great catastrophe of world history. We have a tradition that there were floods beforehand, and there was a great tsunami beforehand, and God sent prophets beforehand to tell people about a moral way to lead life, one of which was Metushelach, who had a special sword with which he could fight demons. That's why he was buried with that sword, and that's why he was given the nickname Metushelach, Met Veshelach Biyado. He passed away with the sword, Shelach is a sword, in his hand. And humanity basically, according to some Midrashim, Metushelach was successful. He had a following of tens of thousands who he convinced to lead a moral life. But once he passed away, they go right back to their old ways, which is a weakness that people have, that leaders can push them. They can push them to the positive, but without the leaders, then they could be drawn to the negative. We don't know too much about the time before the flood. We know that there were giants. We know there were big people. We know there's a medrash that says that when Adam was cursed, when Adam left the Garden of Eden, there was an evolvement in Adam's body. That Adam's body, according to one medrash, was encased with what the medrash calls like a nail that covered his whole body, just like you have nails over the edges of your finger. That's remnants of nails that covered his whole body. That needs a lot of thought and work. There's a medrash that says that people's hands were webbed until Noah. Noah was the first one to be born with hands, with fingers that were separate, that were not webbed. That's why they called him Noah. They said life is going to be more comfortable because we will have better control. We will be able to form instruments. His father was very smart. He saw a baby with split fingers. He realized that humanity was headed somewhere, so we see a certain evolvement. The Medrash also tells us that Noach was born circumcised. So it's also an interesting thing. The physical evolvement together with some kind of spiritual evolvement. King David was born circumcised, and others in Jewish history were born circumcised. So, whatever. Today, most children that are born circumcised, which is 1 in 200, it's usually a deformant. Whatever. Going back to Adam to Noah, so you have a situation where people are super healthy. There's a machlokas rishonim about when the Torah tells us that people live these super long lives. Does that mean literally, or did they count years differently than we count years? Were these people the average, or were they an exception? Machlokas Rambam Ramban. Was everyone living long lives like Adam and the descendants mentioned in the Torah, or were they the exception? Everyone else was living to 80, 90, and they were the exception. What was the world like? Were there seasons or weren't there seasons? Did the day shift, or was there always a 12-hour day and a 12-hour night? Were people sick, or were people always healthy? Our tradition is that people were always healthy, that people did not age, and people did not get sick. These were evolvements that happened later on in world history. So you have a different type of life from Adam to Noah. No sickness. The Talmud says they knew how to operate their legs, and they knew how to take out their spleens, and so they used to be able to run without tiring. They used to be able to work without tiring. They knew that there was a part of the spleen, or maybe the whole spleen, that if you remove, then you could run and not get tired. So they'd be able to run and keep running. They had this longevity that allowed them to master nature, meaning if you lived 1,000 years, then you could experiment and you could follow the stars. And according to some, that's the reason they were granted this longevity, so that they would master nature, which they did. They took advantage of these long lives and they started figuring out how to use different parts of nature. Adam was shown how to use flint, so he was able to make fire. He was shown that on Matzei Shabbos, and that's why on Matzei Shabbos we make the blessing of Borei Me'orei Ha'esh, because that's when he was taught how to produce, how to make fire. So that's, in a nutshell, without going into too much detail, that's what we can discuss between Adam and Noah. Let's see, what else could we discuss? We know there was an evolvement because the snake had feet initially, and then he didn't have feet. So something happened there. What else do we know? In the Tower of Babel, we know that people became monkeys. So that's in the Talmud. Chazal tell us that Adam had a tail, and that tail was cut off and formed into Eve, into Chava. So initially man is created with a tail. The simple understanding is that his children did not have a tail, but that's not addressed. It just says his tail was cut off and formed into Eve. But did Cain and Abel have tails? So that it doesn't say. So there we covered a little bit of the Midrashim from Adam to Noah. Avram, you wanted something before? Yeah, Yaakov.
The overview though that you just gave, we're going to go back to more detail.
I don't think we should go into more details from Adam to Noah, because it's just like in world history, I don't think there's that much more that we need to know. I mean, we could talk about Lilith, but I don't think that's so important. Yes?
Okay, if we're going to say that Mephisholet had the capacity to bring people to an immoral life,
right?
Therefore going to say that there's free will. In line with that, we also say that Hashem looked into Torah and created the world.
Okay.
And there's a necessity for Am Yisrael and Torah and Kulay. If Mephisholet had been successful, then Am Yisrael would never have come into being, and there'd be nothing.
Good question. We'll talk about it later. I don't think we should spend time asking the whys of history, because that's for a Parsha class. You know, it's for another class. Here we're trying to understand what went on. Yeah? I'm purposely not touching on the whys or the themes. I want us first to get a picture of what.
If there was a possibility that this man could have brought the world to a world where of life, then anything and everything after that would not be necessary.
Okay. Yeah.
So you're going to discuss how, I know you kind of briefly mentioned this, that we don't really know if there was years before creation of man. You're going discuss creation, because it is part of what happened. That's not a why or a thing. How Judaism relates to theories about how God created. It's sort of cool saying how the universe certainly happened, but I hear a lot of times that religious Jews would talk about evolution or like some creation process that fits even similarly with how atheists describe that universe coming to being.
So let's leave that for a Thursday night. Bring it up in the question and answer session. I don't see that so much as something here. I think it's more philosophy.
Yeah.
We've addressed it many times.
Yeah.
What? Under the Q&A.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do a search under the Q&A for the word evolution. Yeah.
What is the connection between the spleen and writing?
It seems that they held that the spleen is what tires a person when he runs fast. That's what causes him to be tired. And there's a certain way to operate and take it out. It says in the days of King Solomon, they also knew how to do this. They used to take out a part of the heel and a part of the foot, so they'd lose all feeling in their feet. They'd be able to run, but their feet wouldn't feel the thorns and stuff. They could run on stuff and not feel the pain. And they had a way of operating themselves to see to it that they wouldn't feel... they wouldn't get tired. They wouldn't feel the tiredness of the body. They also knew how to make women barren. This is a skill to, what's it called, to neuter women? No, you don't say neuter about people, right? What is it? To sterilize? Sterilize, yeah. So we see that they learned very quickly how to sterilize women. They wanted them to keep their beauty, which is interesting because they held fat women were beautiful. So I'm not sure why pregnant women were less beautiful. But at any rate, they were sterilizing women from creation already, meaning that's one of the things they were doing between Adam and Noah. They'd have two wives, one to bring them children who could serve them, and another wife for beauty, for their own pleasure. At least two, right? And they were sterilizing the women. Their sterilization didn't always work. We see that Lamech had two wives, and one was supposed to be sterile, and she wasn't, she had kids. So you see, it didn't always work, but generally it worked. It says they knew they had different methods, the Talmud says. Yeah? Okay. So now, which figures would we focus on? We discussed Adam, we discussed Metusalah, and Noah. So we don't know that much about Noah. Noah is usually described as a failure. A failure in the beginning, because he doesn't shift the generation. A failure in the middle, because... he doesn't pray for anyone in the ark, and a failure in the end because he comes out of the ark and he gets drunk and he gets castrated and he gets raped and he ends up cursing his own kid. But the truth is that Noach is a tzaddik. The Torah doesn't describe him as a failure. The Torah describes him as the one righteous person who merits to be saved during this whole flood. So although we have claims against him, but he was a giant. I mean, he's living in a time where everyone else is corrupt, and he is the one that merits to be the continuation of society. Adam was created. Noah had to fend for himself. Adam, so, you know, he was the progenitor of mankind. Well, God created him. He can't take any credit for that. Noah could take credit. Everyone else gets destroyed, and he stands up to the task. So Noah is really a huge tzaddik. It's a mistake that we have this perspective of him. He has flaws, but he's a huge tzaddik. So that's Noach, and Noach doesn't have kids until he's very old. Everyone around him is having kids, and as pious as he is, he doesn't have kids till the age of 500. And Chazal have a system to explain why it was to his benefit that he wouldn't have a lot of kids that wouldn't fit into the ark, but we never understand those midrashim, so we'll leave that hanging. But at any rate, Noach has kids very, very late in life, and he, his wife, his children are all saved, and they are going to be the future of humanity. We see that Noach is powerful enough religiously to make demands towards heaven. And Chazal tell us that after the flood, Noach said, "I don't want to leave the ark. You know, what am I working for if you just destroy the world? So I'll bring more kids. I'll develop a world which you'll destroy all over again. What am I doing here?" So that's tremendous power. And we find that although people were wicked, did Noach really understand what was going on? So Chazal tell us that Avram Avinu didn't understand. That Avram Avinu spent much of his life questioning God. How could you destroy a world like that? That Avram Avinu lived much of his life having a question on God. How come God brought the flood to the world? So the Medrash Tanhuma says, Avram only merited to get the answer to that with the story of Sodom and Amorah. But that means that for 100 years, or 99 years, Avram didn't have an answer. For 99 years, he was looking at God and saying, was there no one righteous? You had to destroy everyone? Why would I leave one family? Avram had a question. So if Noah had the answer, then I find it hard to believe that Avram had a question. So then maybe Noah also didn't have the answer, because Avram had contact with Noah's son, at least, if not Noah himself. So that's another point to ponder. What was Noah thinking during the flood? He's hearing all the wailing outside, and he knows everyone's going. He knows everyone's sinful. Does he really know everyone? So that's the giant called Noah. And next week or next time, we'll pick up with Noah and work our way to Avram and move forward from there.